From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I didn't want to kick my students out of the classroom. As a teacher, I never wanted to go there. And I don't think the society wants me to go there. And I thought if I told the story, if I just told their story and my story, people would understand why they shouldn't have this debate at a school and why they should never ask a teacher to kick students out or deny education to anybody.
A California school teacher becomes a filmmaker to describe how Proposition 187 affects her students. A secret Marine squad kills a teenage goat herder on the Texas border. Residents question whether the war on drugs is really a war against them. And the cost of computers is higher than you think. Add toxic waste and water pollution to your bill. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Premier Li Peng today hailed the resumption of Chinese sovereignty over Hong Kong as a new era and wooed rival Taiwan by suggesting reunification under a similar recovery formula. Li spoke before about 4,000 people at a reception in Beijing to celebrate China's recovery of sovereignty over Hong Kong at midnight yesterday. Reunification was a major theme of his speech hours after the end of what China saw as 156 years of humiliating colonial rule by Britain over Hong Kong. A Belgian military court yesterday acquitted two soldiers accused of torturing a Somali boy in 1993, saying their actions were just a playful game. The soldiers were photographed by a Belgian newspaper, stretching the boy over an open fire and roasting him. Yesterday, they were acquitted of engaging in torture, assault and battery, and threatening behavior. The court found that the two Belgian army privates meant to discourage the child from stealing. The prosecutor told reporters that the court decided it was a form of playing without violence. A federal appeals judge in Virginia cleared the way late yesterday for Virginia's parental notice abortion law to take effect today. The law had been blocked earlier yesterday by a federal judge acting on a request by Planned Parenthood. The law requires physicians to tell parents when their unmarried daughters under 18 seek abortions. In its lawsuit, Planned Parenthood alleged the law gives judges too much discretion in deciding whether young women are mature enough to have an abortion without their parents' knowledge. 39 states have passed laws requiring girls to obtain the consent of or notify one or both parents prior to an abortion. This, according to the New York-based Center for Reproductive Law and Policy. Richard Reardon took the oath of office yesterday for his second term as mayor of the nation's second largest city, Los Angeles, stressing education and public safety as his top priorities. The 67-year-old millionaire businessman-turned-politician spent much of the first four-year term contending with a city reeling from riots after the Rodney King verdict and scarred by the devastating 1994 earthquake. One of the first major decisions of a second term will be choosing a successor to Willie Williams. The city's first black chief was denied a second five-year term by the Civilian Police Commission. Rosa Parks, who stepped onto a bus and became a symbol for the civil rights movement, wants to set up a new model for education. Ms. Parks was scheduled today to formally launch a summer and after-school program that could become a national model. The schools would focus on issues such as civil rights, language arts, and nonviolence training. Pathways to Freedom School and Tried Stone Day Camp held its first classes yesterday with 80 pupils from kindergarten through 12th grade in attendance. That news from Detroit. In Kentucky, a man who killed a convenience store clerk during a robbery that netted him $1,500 was executed in the electric chair early today, becoming the first prisoner executed in Kentucky in 35 years. Governor Paul Patton rejected Harold McQueen's request for clemency yesterday, and the U.S. Supreme Court refused his request for a stay of execution. The Clinton administration is planning to set up an all-Africa military force. Troops are to be dispatched to seven African countries beginning next month. A State Department spokesperson says the U.S. troops are being sent to Africa so the countries there can be trained not to rely so much on others to respond to crises on the continent. A Senate version of the foreign aid bill does not include the training money. In Georgia, with the state's prison commissioner watching, guards with batons beat prisoners who were being restrained or were lying on the floor during a sweep at a prison. This according to a guard in a sworn statement. Lieutenant Ray McWhorter, who heads one of the riot squads at Hay State Prison at Tryon, Georgia, said in a deposition that Corrections Commissioner Wayne Garner did nothing from when A.G. Thomas, director of Corrections Department facilities, dragged an unresisting prisoner by the hair. The deposition was made for a lawsuit alleging that prisoners prisoners at the Northwest Georgia prison were beaten and abused during the July 1996 surprise search for contraband. Once Thomas attacked the prisoner, the guards jumped in and began beating other prisoners. This again, according to Lieutenant Ray McWhorter. This news from Turkey: a pro-Western secular coalition received presidential approval yesterday to replace an Islam-inspired government that was effectively ousted by the military because of its religious agenda. The new premier, Mesut Yılmaz, has promised to cut back religious education as requested by the military and has said he supports his country's bid for full membership in the European Union. Yılmaz replaces Necmettin Erbakan, whose refusal to curb his Islamic policies despite directives from the army sparked rumors of a possible coup in this NATO member country. The military is considered the guarantor of modern Turkey's secular traditions. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The shooting death of an 18-year-old goat herder by a secret U.S. Marine anti-drug squad in the small farming town of Redford, Texas, has sparked renewed controversy over the increasing U.S. military presence along the Texas-Mexico border. On May 20th, Ezequiel Hernandez was shot and killed by Marines from the Joint Task Force 6, known as JTF-6, a military force established to crack down on illegal drug activities on the U.S. border, or so they say. The Hernandez shooting was the second on the border this year involving JTF-6 and the first fatality since the program was launched in 1989. Joining us now to talk about the case is Maria Jimenez, the director of the American Friends Service Committee's Immigration Law Enforcement Monitoring Project, which is based in Houston, Texas. The group documents human and civil rights violations in the enforcement of immigration law. And Kevin Zeese, the head of Common Sense for Drug Policy, a group working to increase discussion of drug policy alternatives based in Washington, D.C. He's also on the board of Drug Policy Forum of Texas, a drug policy reform group also based in Houston. Maria Jimenez, let's go back over the story of Ezequiel Hernandez, who he was and how he died.
Basically, Ezequiel Hernandez was a sophomore in high school in Presidio, Texas, and lived in a small community about 18 miles from Presidio called Redford. The community has about 100 residents and where people know each other by name and see each other every day. It's a fairly isolated community. The nearest airport from Redford it requires a four-hour drive. And so it's a fairly isolated town in the West Texas and in hilly country along the border. Ezequiel and his family have lived there for about three generations. In the town in Redford, they have a cheese cooperative, and so Ezequiel and his family participated in that cooperative as members, and they basically worked on getting the milk from goats that they raised. And Ezequiel Hernandez, as a high school student who, according to everyone, was a fairly quiet young man, very respectful and very routine about his duties, both his schoolwork and coming home and then taking his goats out to herd around his home, did so on May 20th. And like every other day that he did his work, he took along with him his .22 caliber rifle, which was a rifle handed down from his grandfather, been three generations in the family, a necessary instrument according to all Redford residents because of their isolation, and there are a lot of animals, particularly snakes. And Ezequiel apparently routinely used it precisely to shoot at animals that were around the herd. And sometimes he would even target practice. That's what residents say. On this particular day, according to the Redford residents, no one heard any shots except one shot. And that one shot was the fatal shot that killed Ezequiel. And it turned out that he was shot by a Marine who was part of a recognizance effort under Joint Task Force 6, and they were there doing surveillance. Unknown to Ezequiel, unknown to the family, and unknown to the town of Redford, and according to county officials, unknown to the county officials as well. The versions originally told to the public by the Marines was that they shot him in self-defense because he had shot twice at them and they had no choice but to defend themselves. But later investigations, particularly by the Texas Rangers and by local authorities, indicate that there are a lot of contradictions in that particular version. It's been uncovered that the Marines actually stalked him for 20 minutes, and at first when they sighted him, he was about 750 feet from them, and in stalking him, getting closer to him, they actually narrowed their distance from him, and he was shot, according to press reports, something like 250 feet from where they were, but basically after they had followed him for a while. He was shot in the right side, which is contradictory to anyone who's shooting frontally at the Marines. The other thing was that it was discovered that, later and let known to the press by the sheriff of the county of Presidio that he had been contacted about this incident, and he had gone down to the area, but he was told not that Ezequiel had been shot, but that he had hit his head. And so the sheriff had no idea that this young man was wounded, but apparently that's what had happened. He was shot. He was wounded. The authorities came 20 minutes later. The sheriff didn't know he was shot because he was shot with an M16, and this is a bullet that stays within the body and tears up the internal organs. So he was bleeding internally, apparently, at some point, the sheriff is informed that he has been shot, and this is when he calls the ambulance. The Border Patrol says they called the ambulance immediately when contacted by the Marines, but the sheriff indicates that, as far as he knows, he was the first to contact ambulance services. The autopsy at this point indicates that Ezequiel Hernandez bled to death. And so the whole incident has created a great deal of concern about the use of military personnel in U.S. soil policing civilians, because when you look at the incident, the Marines actually acted the way they're trained to act, in the sense that they're trained to shoot to kill, and they're not trained to give any type of aid to whomever they shoot. They're trained to let the enemy die. And so it is really a very disturbing incident, an unfortunate incident of a young man whose aspiration was to become a park ranger, who was an active young man who had no idea the Marines were watching him, might not have even known that they were there, and basically a community which was, in fact, and this is the way the community expresses it, was invaded, and probably Ezequiel Hernandez died a victim, a casualty of the war inside the United States, a war declared against drugs, but ultimately it's against the civilian population.
Maria Jimenez, director of the American Friends Service Committee's Immigration Law Enforcement Monitoring Project. She's talking to us from Houston, Texas. And as I said, we're also joined by Kevin Zeese in Washington, D.C., head of Common Sense for Drug Policy, that works to increase discussion of drug policy alternatives. Kevin, I thought it was illegal for military forces to be used in domestic law enforcement. According to the Times on Sunday, the Reagan administration secured a historic loosening of 19th century laws barring the use of military forces in domestic law enforcement. What, it's legal now?
That's right. For most of the history of the United States, we've had clear laws that separated the military from civilian enforcement. And we survived that way for, you know, a century. But it was in 1981 that the Reagan administration began to put some holes in that wall. And in 1989 and 1991, the Bush administration expanded those holes greatly, to the point now where the military is the lead agency under law responsible for interdiction of drugs coming in the border. And since 1989, they've been allowed to operate domestically, setting up bases, putting in roads, working with the civilian officials, working domestically to help enforce civilian laws. And now what we see is across the country, the military, in particular the National Guard, is working on a wide range of drug enforcement activities, not just along the border, although that's the most militarized as far as active duty military goes. We've seen the National Guard working in virtually every state, in particular involving marijuana enforcement. I think it's important for the public to think of the Hernandez case as really the tip of the iceberg of a very significant change in the way we are doing our policing in the United States. There's been a lot of talk in recent years about community policing and police becoming part of the community, but really the radical change that has occurred in the last 15 years has been a militarized police force, where we see SWAT teams, for example, which didn't exist 20 years ago, now throughout the United States. Almost every drug search warrant, for example, in Fairfax County, a suburban county in Virginia, upper middle class county, is served by the SWAT team. In Fresno, California, the SWAT team actually patrols downtown Fresno, military camouflaged troops, groups of them, walking through the city streets. We've had the military work in 21 cities now in training programs with civilian police, getting out there and dropping out of helicopters in the middle of the night without warning the civilian population, dropping out of helicopters and doing urban guerrilla warfare training.
Kevin, our listeners may remember Professor Peter Kraska, who we had on a few weeks ago, talking about this study he did. He's a Kentucky professor of these SWAT teams in the United States.
Yes, it's a widespread problem. I really urge the public to get educated about this. The Drug Policy Forum of Texas has a website which has all of the Hernandez articles and other information. I think we need to get educated, and the public needs to get active. If you really believe in democracy now, this is an issue that really has maybe one of the greatest threats to our civilian policing.
What is that website that you've got?
The website for Drug Policy Forum of Texas is worldwide, www.mapinc, that's MAPINC, .org/DPFT. World Wide Web, mapinc.org/DPFT. And that has a compilation of all of the news articles, a speech I gave down in El Paso, other materials on this issue. And I really urge the public to get educated and get active on this. We need to use this Hernandez case as a wake-up call. If we don't react, we are doing a shame to the history of Ezequiel Hernandez. We need to wake up and get active and reverse this trend toward militarization.
Maria Jimenez, there's a quote in the Times piece on Sunday. They actually did a front page piece on the killing of Ezequiel Hernandez. And they quote Enrique Madrid, the archaeologist who knew Hernandez all his life, who says, "I'm telling you, the only way they could have botched this up more is if they shot Mother Teresa. If there was only one truly innocent man on the border, it was this young man, and he's the one who got killed." What now are people in Redford, Texas doing?
Well, the people in Redford have set up a committee, Redford Residents Committee for Justice. They are basically exploring the possibility of legal action from the community. The family already is looking into the wrongful death suit to file against the authorities responsible. As far as the rest of us are concerned, we are supporting the efforts of both the family and the Redford community to seek justice for Ezequiel Hernandez and for themselves as a community who has become the most eloquent spokespersons of the experience of being civilians who are being policed by our own military. And they are also asking people to hold different types of events on the anniversaries every month of Ezequiel's death. He died May the 20th. We had a series of events around the country on June 20th, 21st, and 22nd called the National Days of Reflections. And we're holding July 20th also and around those dates. National Days, again, of Action and Reflection for those who may want to simply study more about the issue and get together with groups to study about the issue. We have a couple of videos available and material so that people can actually get together, and even if it's an informal luncheon or something formal like a an event can support their actions in support of Ezequiel Hernandez and in support of the family and the Redford residents.
Maria Jimenez.
In the next week or two, well, mid-July, the Redford residents will also go to Washington, D.C. to talk to policymakers and organizations on a national level about their experience, because ultimately it is a very serious question of democracy and how we live in this society. And that is, I think, what the Redford residents expressed at the very first meeting where I attended.
Well, we plan to try to reach them when they're in Washington to talk with the Redford residents about the killing of Ezequiel Hernandez and what can be done about the militarization of the border. Maria Jimenez, director of the American Friends Service Committee's Immigration Law Enforcement Monitoring Project based in Houston, Texas, and Kevin Zeis, head of Common Sense for Drug Policy. I want to thank you both very much for joining us. And if you want to get more information again on his case, on the case of Ezequiel Hernandez, you can go to the web at www.mapinc.org/DPFT, and that's how you can find out the information. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. In 1994, California voters approved Proposition 187, a ballot initiative denying public education and health care to all undocumented immigrants. Laura Angelica Simon, a Mexican immigrant and fourth grade teacher at Hoover Street Elementary School in Los Angeles, decided to make a film about the impact of Proposition 187 on her kids, on the students of Hoover Street Elementary School. It's a very inspiring documentary and a painful one, because these big public policy issues that we talk about every day, we watch them played out in the lives of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds, and that's where it has the most impact. The film, which is called Fear and Learning at Hoover Elementary, won the 1997 Sundance Freedom of Expression Award in January, and we're very happy to have with us Laura Angelica Simon in our studios. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, why don't you tell us about how you came to make this film, you, an elementary school teacher, why you chose this medium?
Well, I decided to make it a film as opposed to a book or an article because I was simply too emotional about the issue. When 187 passed in California, the idea of a teacher kicking her own students out of the classroom was just too devastating for me. I didn't go into education because I wanted to hurt children, ever.
What do you mean kicking her own kid out of the classroom? Explain what Prop 187 does.
What Prop 187 does, actually, is it denies education to undocumented children. And it denies them public education and health care benefits. So about 50% of my classroom is undocumented, or across the border, or their family crossed the border illegally. And they are in my classroom, and the situation was that with the bill's passage, the teachers were going to be the enforcers, or the INS agents of the community. And our job would be to identify the child, report them to the office, and then report the office would then call the INS and have the children taken out of the classroom, and the family also reported and deported. So that was, in principle, what we were being asked to do by the society. Now, it's still stuck in the courts. We've literally never done that. But it passed, that bill passed by an overwhelming majority in California. Overwhelming. Huge numbers voted in favor of it. And as a teacher, I just couldn't bear it.
talk about the different eyes that we see Prop 187 through in your film.
Well, I tried to make a film that was more historical than political. And by that I meant I wanted to capture a slice of what was happening at a place in time. And the place was my school, and the time was a time when the society decided to have this public policy debate on the backs of my school children. But I felt I needed to show every point of view. And at our school, we had a lot of teachers who voted in favor of Proposition 187, even though they are teaching kids who are undocumented, even though the bill was going to ask them to become the INS agents, the immigration agents of the community. They didn't seem to mind that. And what I tried to do in my film was simply capture every voice, and particularly, though, give my children, the students, a voice in this debate. I asked them, how do you feel about the fact that you may be denied school? How does that make you feel? What do you feel toward me as a teacher? What do you feel about your community?
Among you guys, do you know what the word illegal means? Legal alien?
Yes.
How does that word make you feel? What does it mean? Go
ahead. I feel when they call us illegal aliens, that they're calling us like we're not human beings. Like we're just a little piece of dirt or something. Like you want to feel like human beings like Americans do too.
That they don't want us here. That they're telling us bad things and they don't like us here.
They treat us like if we're enemies.
Oh,
and like if we're their enemies or something.
And I wanted people to see where they live, how they live. How do immigrants in America live? I thought that was critical.
Tell us about Maida, one of the little girls you focus on.
When I grow up, I'm going to be a person that's going to fight for this country. I'm going to be an important person. I'm going to a good college, and I'm going to learn really good until I get that job. And I'm going to fight for the person. I want to be an important person. I want them to be glad of me. I want them to come to me and say, thank you. I want to be a lawyer.
Maida is one of my students, or was one of my students when I shot the film. And the reason I chose her is that the day after the bill passed, I showed up to work like I always show up. And I was in the classroom a few minutes, usually when you chat with the kids before you get things started. And she put her hand up in the air. And I said, yes. And she said, so are you now a cop? Are you going to kick me out of the classroom? And I was really, really devastated by that. As a teacher, I never wanted to be put in that position. And I told her that everything was fine, that nothing had changed at Hoover, but I knew in reality that it had, that we were not the same place that we were before, that we, before this bill and the passage of the bill, were the safe haven of the community. This is a very poor community, and most of our population is immigrant. And, you know, at the school, we pass out food. We have food banks. We have clothing banks. We organize vaccinations. I translate for my parents. I sometimes drive them to, you know, hospitals. And I had become a refuge, a place, a safe place for my children and for their parents. And suddenly I was someone to be distrusted, and the school had become a very cynical place. And so I felt the need to do something, and the thing I ended up doing was shooting this film, just simply try to capture what was happening before me. You know, the division at our school, the distrust, and the toll it was taking on the kids, both legal and illegal.
What are the divisions that it created?
Well, unfortunately, it created divisions between people who voted in favor of 187 and those who voted against, mostly us as the teaching staff. And that came across ethnic lines. Definitely there were Latino teachers who were very against it, like myself, and teachers who were not Latino, who were mostly monolingual and Anglo-Saxon, who voted in large part in favor of it. A lot of them did. And that definitely created an ethnic division in our school. But as the film shows, the issue is much more complex than that. And it isn't a white-brown issue. So that's too simple. That in reality, we as Latinos were also very, very divided. Prop 187 received a large support number of voters from the Latino community. A lot of Mexicans voted in favor of it.
Tell us about the woman who did vote in favor of it.
Well, one of the things you realize in the film is somebody who was very critical to the anti-187 movement wasn't as sincere about it as she was when she was organizing it, that she had hidden feelings, and she wasn't alone. And that's very hard for me. What's happening in California is that most of the immigrant population that's arrived in the 80s is Central American. Meanwhile, the more established community is Mexican, like me. I came in the 60s, and you know, and most of my relatives came in the 70s. We are speaking English. We've been educated. We've done okay. And unfortunately, there is a tension between the Central American new arrival and the more established Mexicano, sometimes Chicano. And a lot of Latinos voted in favor of 187. The issue of racism is much more complex.
You said she was a key anti-187 organizer?
Yeah. She organized the woman in our film that we profiled, the Latina, organized. She is born in Mexico and came out in the 80s, actually. Organized the anti-187 movement at our school, also was the first person to organize an anti-187 movement in the city of Los Angeles, which took place at Hoover Elementary, my school. And as she reveals in the film, she had misgivings about that.
She voted for 187.
She voted for it. She really did. And she explains to us why in the film.
But then why did she organize against it?
Well, that's the complexity of it. I think I was talking to somebody earlier. What happened in California, or at least in Los Angeles, was what you saw happen in Louisiana. There was a lot more support for David Duke than people wanted to admit eye to eye. But when they went into this room to vote, they had a very different agenda, a different feeling. And that's the complexity and the grayness of, I guess, racial relations that we capture in the film. That sometimes, I mean, to me, it was a level of human betrayal. I was stunned to find out that she had voted in favor of 187. I was a friend. I was a fellow Latina, a fellow immigrant from Mexico. And she, I thought, was part of this team who was fighting against it, but obviously harboring very different thoughts, which you see in the film. It's stunning. It felt like a deep betrayal for me. It really did.
Why did she tell you?
I have a joke. I think she told me because she's a Catholic, and you know, you give a microphone to a Catholic and we have a need to confess. She needed to confess it. She felt very guilty. You know, it was this thing where she is still an immigrant and she still suffers with the rest of us. What it is, you know, what it is, this journey to come to America, what we have to learn, the language, the inequities, the struggle. I mean, I felt it too. I came here not speaking English. It was terrible. It was humiliating. It was horrible. But you assimilate and you learn the language and you learn to defend yourself. And she's not as far in the journey as I am. And she felt a conscience. She felt the need to express it. I don't know exactly what propels somebody to confess something so deeply personal, something that could cost them their job and their standing in the community.
We're talking to Laura Angelica Simon, who is a Mexican immigrant herself, a teacher at Hoover Street Elementary School in Los Angeles. And after the Prop 187 passed in 1994, she decided to make a film about the kids in her elementary school and the teachers in her school and just see how Prop 187 plays out in the lives of the people who are most affected by it. Tell us about the white, the Anglo teacher who you also feature in this film, who ultimately leaves teaching. But when you first came to the school, you were told she's the one to talk to. She's a model teacher.
I do not want to be kicking my students out of the class. I don't want to say, oh, you're illegal. I'm not going to be a rat. But then again, too, the schools are overcrowded. Teachers are taking a pay cut. We don't have enough money to put all these kids in school. If they don't belong there, they shouldn't be there. I voted yes on 187. I didn't vote yes as a personal issue. I voted for the broad spectrum that we're just running out of money. We can't take care of everyone. And people need to know you can't come here and break a law.
Well, she's also somebody who's going to be watching it. Her name's Diane. She's a character who voted for 187. She's a teacher who openly voted for Proposition 187 in the school, will openly tell you she has issues with immigrants in America, yet most of her students are immigrants. And it's that paradox that I think makes her so interesting, because I shoot her a lot in the classroom, and she's an awfully good teacher. She's very caring. She's very gentle. She's very giving to her students. At the same time, her political beliefs are, you don't belong here. And it's that complexity or that paradox of a human being that so fascinated me, that I thought was critical to this film. It was critical for me in this film to never give you anything that was black and white. I always went for what I thought was the truth, and the truth in these relations lies in these gray areas, these people who are not one thing or the other. It's, you know, when you watch the film, I think you make up your mind, well, this person believes this and this person believes that. By the end of the film, you'll have a very different idea. You literally see these people reveal themselves in a way you've never seen them before. You'll see the characters transform before your eyes. You really will.
One of the things that Diane said, the teacher, that I'm sure is shared by many around this country, one of the reasons Prop 187 passed, aside from a lot of money that was put into it, is that immigrants should just learn English. She said her family learned English. They came from Russia, and then they came to New York. And that if immigrants want to come here, they got to learn the language.
And she does say that. She and a lot of people share the belief that as soon as immigrants come here, they should immediately assimilate. What they don't realize is that it takes a long time to learn the language. It's what somebody says to her. Well, she's been teaching in this inner city neighborhood that is largely Latino for 7-8 years, but she hasn't learned any Spanish. Yet she expects these kids to learn English, you know, in a year when she can't learn the other language in 7 years.
And their parents. She expects their parents.
She expects the parents to, you know, to become fluent immediately. And I think it's an expectation that is really unfair. As an immigrant who is speaking English now and is very fluent, it took me a lot of years, and it took my family a lot of years. And my mother still doesn't speak English very well because she doesn't speak Spanish very well. My mother only went to school to the third grade. She isn't illiterate, but she's close to it. She's barely literate. And she struggles with her second language. On the other hand, I was educated here, and I did become literate in Spanish, and I did become literate in English, and here I am speaking fluent English. What I think has happened with Diane and a lot of people is they see their kids, but they don't make the connection between the kids in front of them and me. They don't see that these kids, that if you invest in them and you give them an education, will one day come back to you speaking fluent English and fluent Spanish and being constructed, you know, members of the society. They've given up on the kids. And in a sense, to me, I feel like they've given up on me. Often I get told at work, you know, well, I don't think of you as Latina. Well, what the heck am I? Of course I'm Latina. You know, I came from Mexico. I was very poor. My family was extremely poor. I didn't speak a word of English. I was debating, actually, the fellow who wrote 187 recently on a radio show. Well, there's five of them, and I won't say his name, but because he could probably get angry. But I felt he was saying to me, I commend you. I commend you for, you know, giving so much to the community and making this wonderful movie and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, would you have commended me? Would you believe in me 15 years ago when I didn't speak a word of English? When I, you know, when I was so poor and my clothes were more tattered, would you have thought I was so special? You know, would you have believed that one day I would have made a movie that was going to affect people the way they did and be the strong and would be in English? He would have given up on me. And I think if I come in the 80s or the 90s, I know I would not have received the opportunities I did because I came in the 60s or 70s. I don't know who I'd be.
One of the things that struck me as Maida was talking when you went with her to her house and how she stayed home in the day alone because her mother was working and working at all different jobs is how hard it is. I mean, if you are working all the time, it's very hard to take classes in English.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. I mean, the parents don't just hold one job. The parents don't often, the parents of my kids don't even earn minimum wage. They are undocumented employees, and sometimes they get paid, and sometimes they don't get paid, and sometimes they get $2 or $3 for, you know, an hour's worth of work, and sometimes less than that. So they often have to hold 2 or 3 jobs. I know Maida's mom has 2 jobs and is basically never around. She has no time to go to school. That would be a tremendous luxury. I mean, for them, if Maida, and she's told me this, if her mom gets sick and she doesn't go to work that day, they don't eat the next day. I mean, they go down to zero money. You know, during the school year, she went homeless. I mean, my students don't have a place to sleep. And it's just devastating to me.
Because they got kicked out after her father was killed?
Her father was killed during the school year as well. He was killed in a robbery. And then the family went homeless at some point as well. They just simply didn't have money.
Something you didn't even know at the time.
I didn't know. As a teacher, you think you know everything. And making this film, I certainly realized that I didn't. Somebody who I thought was very in touch. I thought I was extremely in touch. I learned more things about my students that I didn't. I just didn't know. I didn't know. You know, she showed up. She would show up to school. She would be neatly dressed. She hadn't done her schoolwork, but she was very neatly dressed, and I didn't realize that she had nowhere to sleep that night. I become so, you know, sometimes my kids show up. They slept in a car. They might have slept in a hallway. They may not have eaten. I mean, the story is it's very, very sad for them. At the same time, as you see in the movie, the kids are amazingly optimistic. They love school. They love learning. They are really smart kids. I mean, you see in the film, they are the biggest optimists in this movie. They're amazing. They're very happy kids.
Laura Angelica Simone, a Mexican immigrant and fourth grade teacher at Hoover Street Elementary School in Los Angeles, who became a filmmaker because she was devastated by the whole discussion around Proposition 187. In a special Independence Day POV, that's television with a point of view, tonight, POV will broadcast her documentary. It's called Fear and Learning at Hoover Elementary. It'll broadcast tonight at 10 p.m. on PBS stations around the country. You should check your local listings. And if you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can order a cassette there. Next up, we're going to talk about Silicon Valley, how it's spreading throughout the Southwest, and what is the effect of computer technology. We also want to let you know you can hear us on the web. You can hear us by going to www.pacifica.org, and we're on Real Audio. And you can write to us at democracy@pacifica.org. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton has been touting his new educational strategy. Part of it includes putting computers in as many schools as possible around the country. And yes, the discussion around computer these days is like the discussion around old cars or new cars in the olden days, people always talking about their latest model. Well, think of the computer manufacturing industry, and what often comes to mind are high-tech and super-clean factories. But a new report out this week reveals the seamy side of the high-tech electronic manufacturing industry. The Campaign for Responsible Technology and the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice document in their new report the massive water pollution and water resource depletion caused by high-tech giants like Intel, Packard, and Motorola, IBM as well. The report also challenges the billions of dollars of corporate welfare subsidies given away to some of the wealthiest corporations in the world. We'll begin with Ted Smith, who's coordinator for the Campaign for Responsible Technology, which is an international network fighting against the negative impact of high-tech manufacturing expansion. He joins us from San Jose, California. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ted.
Hi, Amy.
Well, tell us about the findings in your report.
Well, the findings start with kind of chronicling what's happened in Silicon Valley over the last 20 years, where we all thought that the clean industry was going to be the solution to so many problems. And what we found is that, in fact, it's a chemical handling industry that has had enormous environmental consequences, not only here in Silicon Valley, but as the industry has expanded out into the Southwest, it's brought a lot of these problems with them. One of the main things that we've had to contend with here over the years is enormous groundwater contamination. We drink our groundwater as our drinking water, but the industry has been so dependent on chemical usage and particularly solvents and has been very sloppy in the way it's handled those, and so they've leaked into our groundwater supply and has caused extensive groundwater contamination throughout the valley. We now have 29 Superfund sites here, which is what EPA considers to be the worst contamination sites in the country. That's a higher concentration than any place else in the country. To make matters worse, the occupational health problems have been quite well chronicled now. There have been three different epidemiological studies that have shown that the workers in the industry have suffered miscarriages at rates that are 2 to 3 times what the expected normal rates might be. And another well-kept secret is that the predominant production force in the industry is women of color. You know, you see ads in the papers and magazines and on television of people working in their white lab coats. It doesn't at all give you the kind of impression that the kind of industry that we're really dealing with. Now, the other thing is that it's the largest and fastest growing industry in the world. It's truly a global industry. And as it has expanded out to low-wage and low-standard states in this country, it's brought a lot of these problems with them. And this is kind of an internal example of this race to the bottom as a very competitive arena, a world-class arena. This industry has done everything it can to increase its profit rates, which are already very substantial. So it has targeted states like New Mexico and Arizona and Texas for new development, and that development has been going on now for the last almost decade.
Well, let's go to that area. We're talking to Ted Smith from Campaign for Responsible Technology. He's based in San Jose, California, and California, of course, the birthplace of Silicon Valley, the site of Silicon Valley. As it spreads out, it's going around, as Ted Smith is saying, to places like Arizona and New Mexico. We're joined by Sylvia Ledesma of the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice, a group of some 80 different grassroots organizations from the four Southwest border states in Mexico. Sylvia actually comes from Houston, Austin, where some of the reporting was done on the growth of Silicon Valley. The report that they all did together is called Sacred Waters, Lifeblood of Mother Earth, Four Case Studies of High-Tech Water Exploitation and Corporate Welfare in the Southwest. Before you talk about the findings in your area, Sylvia Ledesma, I thought it's interesting how you all came together, how this coalition of groups joined together for this report.
Good morning.
Morning.
First of all, I think we all came together out of the need for a regional, national, and even ultimately an international community response, you know, to the high-tech exodus from the Silicon Valley into the Southwest U.S. Seeing the legacy that was left behind, and actually even continues as some of those industries continue to grow in the Silicon Valley. And deciding, you know, we don't want that in our community, and looking at what needed to be done in terms of holding governmental agencies accountable and the industry accountable, and not only in terms of the environmental contamination and economic welfare, but also in terms of what needed to be done to deal with some of the health issues that have already, you know, occurred.
You're speaking to us from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Albuquerque, New Mexico, the third most arid state in the nation, yet the high-tech electronics companies are being welcomed by local politicians, agencies, and residents for the short-term gains they create, like jobs, higher wages for some, and a perception of an increasing sophistication of their cities. I'm looking at your report, and it says 87% of the water used by the top industrial users in the Albuquerque area is by the five high-tech companies. That's 87% of the water used is used by Intel, Philips, Sumitomo, Motorola, and Honeywell.
Yes, that's correct. And even in terms of what is paid, the residents end up paying four times more for water than industrial users.
Yeah,
and the industry uses a tremendous amount of water, anywhere from 4 to 4.5 million gallons per day of water is used by the industry.
Yet at the same time, you have corporate welfare growing to attract these industries. What kind of movement has grown up in Albuquerque to deal with what you call Silicon Mesa?
Well, one of the biggest factors economically is the job situation. When the wheeling and dealing was going on as to whether Intel would decide to stay here or not, New Mexico offered them an $8 billion revenue bond in return for jobs, what they said would bring jobs. And we're finding that the unemployment rate here has remained the same in terms of the residents that were already here. And what's happening is that Intel is bringing their workforce with them, even causing an even more increase in development and bringing, again, more environmental problems. And also the local residents are having to pay for the new development in terms of infrastructure, and all the growth is coming out of our own tax dollars.
So let's talk about what you feel together, both Ted Smith and San Jose, working with the Campaign for Responsible Technology and Sylvia Ledesma of the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice, what you think are some of the remedies, both the regulatory responsibility, the corporate responsibility, community responsibility, what has to be done? Let's start with Ted Smith.
Okay.
Well, I think I'd like to start with two things. One is, as Sylvia was mentioning, this corporate welfare has gotten really out of hand. Intel has pioneered this with what they call an ideal incentive matrix, where it's a shopping list of over 100 goodies that they have shopped around to the various southwestern states, saying whoever gives us the most goodies, that's where we'll go. I think we've got to put a stop to this. I think it's going to take a lot of networking, a lot of work between the communities, and that's really what we're trying to do through this collaboration, so that we can share information and do organizing strategies to try to stop these kinds of corporate welfare giveaways. We've passed an ordinance here now in Santa Clara County that conditions any kind of subsidy with requirements for good wages, good benefits, and good environmental performance. We think that may be a start if other communities can pass those. And then secondly, this enormous unsustainable water usage and the thirst of this industry just can't keep going on, and so we're pushing for the industry to adopt what we call closed loop or zero discharge standards, which is a technology that's already out there. And if they would simply adopt that across the board, I think it would have tremendous benefit to right now what is the depletion of the water resources throughout the Southwest.
What about community responsibility, Sylvia Ledesma?
Well, I think in order to even network beyond our own communities, regional-wide, we do need to inform our communities as to holding the governmental agencies accountable. For one is for increasing monitoring and oversight of these high-tech companies. I think there could be a lot tighter regulation, because one of the things we're finding is that even some of the regulations that exist are not being enforced. And I think with more community oversight and community pressure, that we can begin to hold the regulatory agencies accountable to enforcement.
And what about
also,
how?
Also, well, just one more thing that I think is happening too in the region, a trend, is the permitting. One of the trends that we have found in the Southwest, as these companies are doing their whipsawing and, you know, wheeling and dealing, and they're going through their list of goodies to see who's going to trade off, is the permitting. They look very closely at that, and in order for a company to move into a community, they have to have a permit, all kinds of permits, anywhere from the emissions, you know, the permit to the environmental permit to even the constructing of the building. And we found that the trend is fast-tracking. Local government just fast-tracks right through, you know, just before the community even has a chance to even give input, and before we even get the information as to what kinds of chemicals that industry is going to put, you know, in our community. And they're stamping everything as these permits go through the applications. The permitting process not only fast-track, but they're stamping them confidential, so that when you ask them or go to the regulatory agency to try to get the information, you can't get the information. And that's a big trend that we have found, and we really need to team up on that and put the pressure on and hold them accountable, because we can't continue to allow these companies to pollute our communities.
How about the politicians, for example, in Albuquerque, New Mexico? Are there some who stand up to the tremendous temptations? I mean, you've got large companies coming in, not the least of which, I'm sure, their concerns for campaign contributions. In fact, I should let our listeners know on Democracy Now! That we'll be extensively covering the campaign finance hearings that should be beginning next week on July 8th. In Congress. Now, they won't raise all the campaign finance issues that we will, but what about this issue of campaign finances and what you find with Silicon Valley? I'll ask both of you, both Sylvia and
Silicon
Ted.
Valley. You first said you're Silicon Valley.
Okay.
Silicon Valley and Silicon Mesa.
Well,
oh, okay.
Yeah, and Silicon Desert, and I mean, it's Silicon everywhere now.
And it's the same, too.
Let me just say that right downtown in San Jose is emerging a new high-tech museum in the center of downtown, and it's hard to get a sense of the importance of this industry to these areas if you don't live here, if you haven't seen it. The industry is just all powerful and all dominant. As I say, it's the fastest growing, largest industry and most dominant industry that we have, and this being the birthplace and the of all of this, people here are, you know, big promoters. This high-tech museum is designed to show the world that this is the birthplace of the semiconductor industry that has transformed things in less than a generation. The local politicians here are very well aware of that. They are very, very reluctant to ever cross the industry on any issues, whether they're environmental or tax or health or wages or benefits or anything else. It's very rarely that the local politician will get the courage to stand up, and that it just won't happen unless there's a very strong and vibrant, well-organized community organizing effort. And, of course, the other thing that hasn't been said is that this industry is about 99%, as they say, union-free, so there is no benefit of working with the organized workers and trying to do some of these things.
And in Albuquerque, Sylvia Ledesma?
Yeah, I think in Albuquerque is probably, it's probably even a little bit more blatant. The politicians are out there. They're working like hand in hand with the developers, as the local community grows. And for one quick example, there's a Petroglyph National Monument that's right near Rio Rancho, where Intel is located, and that community has outgrown itself, and it doesn't have any more room for the growth in that direction. There's a river on one side, and then the petroglyphs on the other.
And the petroglyphs are...
It's a national monument. It's a sacred site of the Pueblo Indians. Indigenous people here still continue to do their ceremonies there. And according to federal law, you cannot put a road, you cannot construct a road through a national monument, a park, unless it serves a park purpose. And right now there are two proposed highways to be built through the petroglyphs. And so that has really, really enraged a lot of the local community, and there's a lot of battle going on. But there is... the Congressman Domenici is pushing legislation to make this a to change the wording on that national policy, but so that it won't only impact here in Albuquerque, it's going to impact nationally to any monument or any
park.
So
Sylvia, we're actually going to cover the whole petroglyph controversy in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, on another show, and we're going to deal with the whole issue of the ballot initiative that community activists are trying to put on. But before we wrap up, which we do have to do right now, I wanted to get your phone numbers for people who are interested in getting a hold of the report, and also your website, the report Sacred Waters, 4 case studies of high-tech water resource exploitation and corporate welfare in the Southwest, which has been released by both of your groups. Ted Smith, the Campaign for Responsible Technology in San Jose, how can people reach you?
Yeah, we're at 408-287-6707, and we share a website with our local organization here, the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition, at www.svtc.org/svtc. And we have a lot of this information, including the executive summary, up on the website.
That's www.svtc.org/svtc. And Sylvia, your phone number in Albuquerque, the phone number of the Southwest Network for Economic and Environmental Justice.
Our number is area code 505-242-0416.
One more time.
Area code 505-242-0416.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us, Sylvia Ledesma and Ted Smith. And I have some welcomes for some new stations. We want to welcome KUGS officially joining us from Bellingham, Washington, and KOPN in Columbia, Missouri. And by the way, we'd love to hear from you folks. You can call us with your comments and issues you'd like to see covered at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. You can get a copy of today's show by calling 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our engineer. Andy York is our Washington engineer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!